Please help support the FitCast going forward, making sure that new episodes are coming to you every single week by going to patreon.com/thefitcast. That's patreon.com/thefitcast. And you can support the show starting at just $1 per episode. And everyone that is supporting the show through Patreon is also getting the episode 7 days early and without any pre-roll stuff like this that you're hearing right now. You can also go to thefitcast.com and click on the PayPal tab on the left-hand side and do the same thing. But again, going forward, these episodes are going to get done based on the support of the audience. So thank you so much to everyone out there that is supporting the show, and I hope you support it going forward. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 313. I am Kevin Larrabee, broadcasting from somewhere outside of Tokyo, Japan. And thanks to the magic of Skype, we are connecting all the way to some desert in Saudi Arabia, where I was able to track down Jonathan Fast, who's been on a dig. He's been on a dig site looking for the Holy Grail What was that guy's name? The guy, the guy who said
the joke.
Yeah, the big dude from Indiana Jones who wasn't in Last Crusade. Who like John Rhys Davies, who was also in Sliders. Anyways, John's here. John, what's up?
What's up, man? I think I'm probably a few hundred miles south of where the Holy Grail might be. That's just I think so. What's that called? A palindrome or something? When it's forwards and backwards, is it the same? The episode 313?
Sure.
I don't know if that's it. I'm going to get a bunch of people. John's such a dumbass, not even palindrome.
Episode is not.
Right, but 313 is.
Yeah. That's why everyone in New York loves 212.
Right.
It's a great song about area codes, but we're here to talk about pain because this is something that, you know, we haven't talked a lot probably in the last 6 months or so, but you know, I've still been following what you've been doing on Facebook, and one of the big things that you've been researching and that you've been investigating and that you've been talking to people about and kind of debunking some of the other stuff people have been, you know, posting out there is in regards to like pain science. And I'm coming to this interview as someone that has not clicked on those links. That has kind of toned out a lot of the conversation because I was like, I'm not in pain. I don't really care. I think I'm okay. So, but I can see how it will be really good for people out there that are dealing with chronic pain issues, or, you know, maybe you can help just shed some light on this subject. And, you know, I want to kind of start off the episode just kind of giving you the floor and saying, John, why the hell is this so interesting and why should people care about this?
Right. From a personal standpoint, I probably started reading this stuff just 2 or 3 years ago, which is a shame on me because this field of science has been conducted for the past 40-50 years. So that tells you how much information that they have collected and how little, at least health and fitness as a majority, really, and including rehab as a physical therapist, because this is stuff that I didn't really learn even in school or in my residency. You have little whispers of it, but no one really seems to pay much attention to it. So there's a lot of information out there and it just doesn't seem to be getting out there, which is why I think that it's valuable to talk about these things, and a lot of the guys that are also spreading information like this think it's valuable. So for myself personally, it was more of just a curiosity because I started seeing things about pain science or how pain works in the body, and it would answer questions that you would have as a postural structural practitioner, meaning, you know, your posture is going to cause you an injury or the way that you move, and, you know, the kind of basic stuff that I think floats around the internet. I don't, you know, John does cross syndrome and hell, just listen to any episode that we recorded like 3 years ago. I'll talk about it, I'm sure. So I started looking at it from that standpoint, just as a as a physical therapist, kind of wondering what this stuff was all about. But of course, my wife, Marianne, actually suffers from chronic pain, and she's been vocal about it. She's written some really awesome articles about it too on her website. So you could go to myomytv.com. She's got some cool stuff about chronic pain there. But once she and I started a relationship, I really started looking into this stuff, because now it was certainly relevant from a person that I cared about, and something personal that I could take from it. And what I think is valuable about pain science is it really explains much of the human condition. We're working with individuals, working with clients, if you're a personal trainer, or you know, certainly patients as a health practitioner, and these people more or less will come to you in pain, right? Every personal trainer has that client that has, you know, their back is funny or their knees sometimes hurt or whatever that is. And the information that you get from researching into pain science can help you to improve their function. You know, if you're a physical therapist or a medical doctor, you're going to encounter people in chronic conditions. It's increasing almost exponentially. I mean, the rate is just unfortunately just exploding, and the cost to our economy and to society in general are absolutely enormous. So it really it's valuable and important to understand the mechanisms of pain and to undo some of the kind of myths that are out there right now that do not help our patients. They, at least if they do, it's not because of the things that you think they're doing. And on the flip side of it, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, that when you have false information about pain, you can actually make pain worse. That's what's crazy about this. So accurate information is vital in helping these people get better. And that's what I think is what's so important about this stuff, and why I've taken such an interest to it. Because when we think about what we want to do as practitioners and help the people and to do no harm, then understanding this stuff actually allows us to do just that. And not understanding it can produce actual harm.
Okay, let's talk about another thing that I saw you posting a lot about is the term like nocebo.
Right.
So maybe you can explain that, and hopefully that leads you, you know, more into this discussion.
Right. So that's exactly what I was referring to, basically. Yeah. So we have, I think most people are probably familiar with the placebo effect. The placebo effect is something that appears to occur from non-specific means. So in other words, if I take a pill, if I take a medicine, if I take Tylenol, for instance, I assume that will reduce whatever pain I'm feeling. And the idea is that the mechanisms of that pill are specific, meaning that when I take this pill, there's medicine and that medicine makes me feel better. Non-specific is what can sometimes be placebo, meaning that I take a pill, but it's actually a sugar pill. It's inert. It's not meant to do anything. And yet, for some reason, I feel better. So this is what these, you know, pharmacology studies are. And that's where we tend to get our understanding of placebo. They'll give, in order to justify the use of a drug on the market, they need to show that it works better than just basically nothing. But nothing actually can have an effect. So as counterintuitive as that seems, it appears that our brain can reduce our pain just by thinking that it's taking something that will do that already, right? So it's almost like just by expecting to feel better, you'll actually feel better. And the placebo effect is actually well studied and fairly well understood, not perfectly, but fairly well understood to basically be just that. It's the brain in expectation. But there are many types of placebo effects. There's not just one. But all of them seem to focus on this idea that I do something that really shouldn't work, and yet for some people it actually did. And this affects us as manual therapists or even personal trainers, because we can have these type of effects just from environmental cues, from our attention to the individual, from doing things that the individual expects to feel better. So there's a big controversy with acupuncture, for instance, and in acupuncture in well-controlled trials does not seem to be anything but a placebo effect. And you know, practitioners or people that have had acupuncture work for them don't want to hear something like that. But all that's really saying is that the effects of acupuncture are non-specific, meaning that It's not the needles that are doing it. It's not the meridians or anything like that, but it just appears to be the attention, the focus, and the expectation that something will go well. Now, the opposite side of that is called the nocebo effect, and it's exactly the opposite. Not exactly in mechanism in the brain, but it is the opposite in experience and effect. And that means that if you expect something bad to happen, something bad may actually occur. So what they'll find, they first start discovering nocebo effect, where they might give you a sugar pill or a real pill, and in these studies nobody knows. You're given, it's called a double blind. So if I'm the medical doctor that's experimenting, I give you a bottle of pills and I don't know if this was the real pills or the fake pills. You as the patient don't know either. It's just a blank bottle. But within the course of this, I'll explain that, you know, this drug is meant to, you know, make you feel better or cure this disease or whatever, but the possible side effects are nausea, headache, you know, something like this. And what they find is that they're just as expected, some people will experience these side effects. But unexpectedly, many of the people experiencing the side effects were on the fake pills. They were on the sugar pills. So rather than feeling the benefit, or possibly even by feeling the benefit of the placebo effect, they may get better by the thing that they're studying, but they will also report the side effects that were recommended by the researchers. But it's a sugar pill. So just like you wouldn't expect anyone to feel better from, you know, ingesting a pill of nothing, they also feel worse from ingesting a pill of nothing. And that's the idea of the nocebo effect. And we understand that the nocebo effect is not just necessarily by taking a pill. You can have pain that is suggested. You can have environmental cues that something is negative. You might think of it as if I asked you to walk through a dark alley and I told you this is a really bad part of the neighborhood, so just so you know, it's possible you'll get attacked. You're going to experience physical changes to your body, anxiety, stress response. You'll be tight. You'll move differently. Your heart rate, your breath rate, all these things will be affected just by the suggestion that harm might occur. And although that's not specifically the nocebo effect, I think it works to give you an idea of how that kind of works in the brain and in the human body. And that's why I think it's important that we understand the pain science itself, because now let's take that to the gym, right? You see a patient, you see a client that's squatting and their knees are falling in a little bit. And rather than correcting it, you feel it's your job to mention that, well, they might get injured, right? They might hurt their knees. If you keep squatting that way, it's going to be bad for you. And now you've done exactly what I just described. You've created the potential for a nocebo effect. And if this individual has someone in their family history, maybe their dad had really bad knees or their grandparents needed knee replacements, this is something that has been kind of in the back of their mind for a very long time, and now you've just told them that squatting may hurt their knees if they do it badly, but it's an ill-defined bad, right? What is bad? Where are the knees going? What's good? How do I need to move? What you may have actually done is created the potential for experiencing pain where there is no tissue injury. And that's what I think is very valuable to understand about this, and where even a personal trainer who does not specifically work, you know, just for people that are experiencing pain can benefit from learning about stuff like pain science.
Okay, so, you know, for a lot of people that are tuning into the podcast, we obviously have a lot of the, you know, general population, you know, the weekend warrior types, and there's obviously also trainers, coaches, things like that. So I want to just give you two examples, and what advice would you give to these people? So,
sure.
You know, this is someone that is tuning into the show who lifts 3 days a week, and, right, you know, they're starting to hear about this information and wondering, all right, if I'm just going in and training by myself, how is this information affecting me, and what, you know, how should I digest some of this to just, mm-hmm, you know, in terms of what should I now consider now that I know that, you know, there's a possibility that I could, you know, have to deal with some of this stuff.
Right. Well, pain itself, and we'll back up for a second, but because what I just told you kind of gets interpreted as, oh, it's in my head type of explanations, and that's not what pain science explains. Pain is under this now understood under the umbrella of biopsychosocial. So beforehand, we might have thought of biomedical, which is the idea of pathologies or injuries, or structural functional, like I mentioned before, postural structural rather, where you talk about someone's posture, the way someone's moving as a cause of injury. But injury itself is not always what we're interested in, because there are many, many people walking around with actual tissue damage and they have no pain and no understanding that they have any real damage. There are unbelievable studies of, kids, 12 to 18 year old tennis players that they'll just put them in an MRI machine and see what they find. And they're finding spine fractures, muscle tears, tendon tears, unbelievable things. And these kids are playing at high levels and have never experienced pain. I mean, it's fascinating. If you take 100 people off the street and you just put them through an MRI, you'll find that all kinds of issues with their spine and herniations and fractures and crazy kinds of stuff, and no one's ever had any pain. And what that kind of tells you is that injury may be just a natural process. It's just something that occurs to us throughout life, and pain is not specifically an output of that injury. So you have to back up and say, okay, so then why do we experience pain at all? So biopsychosocial explains that pain is not just a function of a physical tissue injury, although certainly this is the most commonly understood pain, right? I just bang my elbow and I feel pain. But rather, by producing pain, it's an emergent property of a human being. And what that means is that it's multiple systems. Everything gets evaluated and analyzed, including the information that's being sent from that injury site. So I bang my elbow and there are nerves that will send threat impulses, right? It's not pain. Pain doesn't come from the tissue itself, but information comes from the tissue, and this information happens to code for this is a threat. This is nociceptive, is what it's called, the nerves are called. So the brain receives that message through a number of mechanisms and will analyze before deciding on the output, right? And sometimes that decision is we're going to ignore this and we're going to downregulate, meaning that we're just going to kind of push this aside. So that's how you'll be looking at your arm and go, hey, I got a bruise here and I didn't even realize it. And that's a very natural thing that occurs with us. Or you might have a little cut on your finger. But these are examples of obvious tissue damage that was never experienced because it was unimportant at the time. So pain is a product of the environment, what you're doing at the time. It's a product of your experience. Do you bang your elbow and is that a dangerous thing, or have you done it 1,000 times and it's probably not necessary to consider at this point, right? So if we bring back that example of the guy that's squatting, if they were raised, even not quite realizing it, but raised in an environment where knees were a bad thing. Daddy can't walk today because his knee arthritis is hurting, or grandpa had to get knee replacements and now he walks with a cane. These are social cues that when the brain is analyzing the situation may call upon these cues and say, actually, you know what, that bump on my knee, that might be dangerous, that might be threatening to my producing whatever the goal is of life, right? This may be threatening to my ability to walk, so I will produce pain. It will emerge from this experience so that something happens, so that I change my behavior, that I go to see a doctor, I get help to reduce this threat. And that sounds weird because you're thinking, well, who's the brain talking to? And in fact, it's talking to itself. The brain is not one entity. You can almost think of it as like multiple brains in a sense. It's systems, and it communicates within itself and with other parts of the body itself, so that when we talk about hormones, when we talk about signals, these are typically signals that are received from other parts, and the brain does that as well. So we can understand that a muscle in the foot is sending information to the brain, and the brain itself is sending information back to itself from the spinal cord back and forth. So this is how this process in a really gross, messy way occurs. So the person that's working out by themselves, when you experience pain, or if you experience pain, the most important thing that you can do to your for yourself is to basically remain calm, right? If we experience pain, this is a warning sign. This is the brain saying, you know what, I don't like what's going on here, and I'd like for you to do something different. You accept that pain and understand it as a signal and seek appropriate help. If it's a little kind of nagging thing, usually we kind of, you know, maybe move the way we're, change the way we're moving, or we take a rest or whatever. If it's a stronger pain, we want to investigate that and make sure that it's not something important, although even the experience of pain itself is not necessarily one-to-one to the amount of damage that's possibly there, which is another sign, you know, another aspect of pain. If we think about it, if we took a paper cut underneath our nail, that would be extraordinary pain, but the damage is very minimal. So the amount of pain that you experience is not necessarily indicative of the amount of damage that could be there, and that can include the absence of damage entirely. But the more that we worry about it, the more that we think, you know, obsess over it, which unfortunately many people do, having pain can be a scary experience, that will make pain worse. We can experience more of it. So the idea here is that we want to remain calm, we want to follow through, we want to observe the pain and acknowledge it and do whatever is necessary to reduce that pain. But what we don't want to do is overanalyze and worry about it until that someone, a professional, has seen it, you know. So we never ignore it when it's significant and seems to impact the way that we're moving or our ability to perform everyday activities. But at the same time, we don't want to think, oh my God, I'm ruined, you know, this pain, I must have torn something, my leg must be broken. We want to stay cool, calm, and collected. And by doing so, you'll reduce the pain as much as you might be able to at that period of time until you seek out medical assistance.
Okay, so I'm gonna, everyone out there, I want you to take a deep breath, because this is, it's kind of a lot to absorb, and so I can, you know, imagine it might be the same for people out there listening. So, all right, we're off to a good start. We got some good core information to start thinking about. But maybe for a second, let's step back again. And, you know, you talked about how you started getting interested in this stuff. And, you know, where have you been looking for, you know, information and studies on this? Has it just been, you know, kind of in a, you know, a core group of people that have been investigating this stuff?
There are tons and tons and tons of people that investigate pain, and because it is such a large field, because there's so many aspects of it and the types of pain we experience, and you can almost think of pain as kind of like, you know, kind of like cancer is, not that it's equivalent, and of course we get pain when we have cancer, but in the idea that people talk about someone, so-and-so has cancer, but cancer is an umbrella term. There are hundreds of versions of cancer, right? And different mechanisms. Some are genetics, some are environmental pressures, some are, you know, lots of different ways that we can develop a cancer. Pain is a similar thing. So even though we all have this understanding of, well, I'm in pain, it actually is an umbrella term for many different types of pain, acute pains that are, you know, pretty much quick and associated with some type of injury, versus chronic pain, which has no specific injury association most of the time, and all different versions of that. It can be neuropathic pain, can it be musculoskeletal pain, can it be, you know, something else entirely. So there are a lot of different researchers that are looking at various types of pain. The most often kind of recommended literature, you might get something from like Wall or Melzack, and these are the original guys that really changed the conversation about pain research, and they've been doing their research for years. Wall passed away, unfortunately, but Ronald Melzack is still with us, and their research and their literature is some of the best stuff out there. But Explain Pain is a book that many people use to first get an understanding of pain science. That's written by Lorimer Moseley, and that's really more of a patient friendly type of book that you might leave in in your waiting room, for instance. So a lot of people have learned about this stuff through that book. But in addition, there's the NOI group, the NOI group, oh my God, I just drew a blank. But
well, while you're thinking for a second, we're going to pause for just 1 second, and we're going to be right back. So go get some coffee, go get some water, grab a pen and paper, and we're going to be right back with more from John. You're fully caffeinated and ready to learn some more about some pain studies and things like that. So yeah, John, continue. I know you're kind of mid-sentence there.
Oh yeah, no worries. Feedback is the enemy of podcasting. But yeah, the other resources, Body and Mind, which is another excellent. They're both free. Their websites and you can kind of look at information there. And of course, Soma Simple is a forum. That's some pretty high level discussion by a lot of people that have been looking at this information for a very long time. So it's not for the faint of heart, but it's just a wealth of information there too. Those are pretty simple areas, before you might look into research or anything like that. They explain the majority of this in an easy to understand and relevant way. So,
well, let's say I believe you. Let's say okay. I believe all you're saying, and I trust you, and I'm buying into this. And sure. People are going to finish listening to the show today, and then they're going to be like, "All right, now where do I go from here?" Obviously, something like Soma Simple is not going to be the next step, like you said. Right. But are there any like articles out there that you recommend? And I think you even wrote one a couple of weeks ago for the PT
DC.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, the one we wrote. I wrote with Matt Danziger, and it was for the PTDC, and that was on nocebo effect, actually. And that was more geared towards – it was a very quick article, but it was geared towards personal trainers. And it was basically exactly what I just described. It's that we can't assume to know when and how an individual is going to experience pain. Pain is something – this is now we're getting to like almost like a philosophy of science, but pain is what's called a qualia. A qualia is something that cannot be broken down any further. It is its own self. So if I were to ask you, let's presume that I'm blind, and I said, "Kevin, could you describe this object to me?" And it happens to be a red square. Okay, what would you do to describe a red square to a blind person?
Is it a 3D square, or is it just like a 2D square on a piece of paper?
No, it's just 2D square on a piece of paper.
I would say it has four sides. Each side is equal in length. And it is colored. And that color is red, which people won't obviously understand because...
Exactly.
They're blind.
How do you describe color or the color of red to a blind person? And the answer is you kind of can't, because it's a qualia. It's something that cannot be described by any other means other than itself, right? So to describe a color red, now a blind person can understand four. They can understand sides. They don't need vision, in other words, to see this. We can break that down, the description of those pieces further so that they can understand it and don't need to actually see it, or rather experience it, to know what you're talking about. But red needs to be experienced, right? If I say a tomato is red, what does that mean? It's only meaningful if you understand what we describe as being red. And therefore, we can't actually assume that my vision and my understanding of what red is the same as your understanding what red is. If we had a conversation with one of those like electrical fish, right? They have these electrical fields that they're able to manipulate. We don't know what that feels like. So for a fish to describe the feeling of that, it may be completely impossible, because unless we could hook our brain up to that fish, that super intelligence suddenly, you know, capable of discussing electrical fields with us fish, we won't actually know what it's feeling. So pain is a qualia. And that seems weird because, well, we all experience pain, but the fact is we don't know what we're actually the other person is experiencing. We understand that it's probably something similar, but we don't actually know that for fact. And when someone says it's shooting, it's sharp, it's, you know, it's dull, it's throbbing, this is describing the behaviors of pain, but it's not actually describing what pain is. Is this feeling of discomfort to the point of emotional response, right? And so to actually describe what pain is to someone that can't feel pain, and there are some people that can't, and unfortunately they don't tend to live very long because they can't actually experience danger threats, and therefore they are exposed to danger all the time. You just don't know that someone else is feeling the same thing. So when we talk about pain and we talk about understanding of pain, part of that experience is just in understanding yourself and understanding what you experience as pain, and to realize that that's not something that potentially another person feels. So when we pass judgments on other people, when we see someone in writhing in pain on the field, right? We're watching football and a guy goes down and we think, oh, they must be a horrific injury, or why are they faking it? It's not even that bad. What we're doing is we're projecting our understanding of what we think we might experience in that same situation and applying that to that individual. So we have to be cautious about this, because this is not actually an accurate way to understand someone else's experience. I went way off topic on that, though. I don't even know how that happened. That just like that. I went into qualia, and then we just went off in another direction entirely. What the hell was your original question?
Well, sometimes you need to take the leash off. I said, you know, if people are, seriously, you know, if at the end of the day, if people are starting to get interested in this stuff, are there any directions where you can point them, like to an article or right, a book or something like that?
Oh, because you talked about my article on the SIBO effect, right? Yeah. That's why I was like, what did he ask me? Didn't he just ask me for a book or something? Yeah, that nocebo effect article. There's some stuff on Marianne's site, actually. So again, myomitv.com, I think we tried to write a really nice intro piece into what pain is. There's been a couple of articles out there on the PTDC and on people's blogs. Todd Hargrove has some fantastic articles on what pain is on his blog. B-Boy Science as well. So there are actually quite a few. If you type in anything into a search like that, biopsychosocial pain or understanding pain or something like that, you'll come up with actually a lot of resources. The information is out there. It's about knowing about actually going to it.
Aren't you a little biased with your marriage? Well,
that's a good question. I mean, I could be, right?
I kind of mean that half jokingly, but the, you know, right, with no, all this stuff, because obviously I've seen Marianne, I've seen her post a lot on, I mean, again, John is super active on Facebook. If you want to see what he's talking about, add him on. Can people still add you on Facebook? Is that cool?
Hell yeah. Yeah.
To kind of see these discussions. But, you know, for people out there who don't know, Marianne gets in a lot of these discussions as well, because, you know, she is, like you said, she's dealt with a lot of the pain issues and things like that. And that's what initially got you intrigued into this stuff. So that's always, again, a question that you need to ask about, you know, it's some kind of like some bias when you want to kind of look for something.
Well, certainly that, I think it's a legitimate question, and the answer is yes. I'm absolutely biased. Now, does that mean that the information that I'm providing is inaccurate? Well, hopefully not, and I don't believe that it is. But is this area of interest an interest because I'm married to someone that's experiencing chronic pain and that we work on this daily. Well, obviously,
yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's still invaluable. Now, how valuable will it be for the everyday trainer? I think it's valuable to understand it. And I think it's valuable to
at least think about it. Like it's super interesting stuff,
right,
to just say, like,
right.
Well, I mean, the only thing that I just, you know, maybe we should just remind people, like, if someone is like going in and doing a, hell, I don't know, if they're doing a bench press and their elbows are too far out, are you going to say, like, oh, well, you don't want to do that because you could run into shoulder problems, or, you know, make sure that you're not doing any pronated chin-ups, because if you do too many pronated chin-ups, like, you're more likely to run into shoulder issues because your shoulder capsules close off or stuff like that. Like is that stuff that, you know, people should just be cognizant about, to not just go too overboard and go nuts with it.
Exactly. When we look at the research into nocebo effect, depending on the study and what they're actually dealing with, it appears that you're looking at somewhere between 30 to 50%, upwards of 50% of people will experience that. So not everyone will experience nocebo effect. Some of them just have no effect. But here's what's interesting about that. There's a really well known study that looked at knee surgery, and I've used this example before in other interviews, but the gist of it is that they were performing this knee surgery, and this surgeon that performed the study realized that they didn't have any actual evidence that it was doing anything. Now, they know that it gets great results, but they don't have evidence as to why. So what he did was perform this, what's called a triple blind study, which is just fantastic, and it means that nobody had any idea what was going on. So you'd be a patient, and you'd come into his office, he'd offer the study to you, and you'd accept. You get prepped for surgery, you go into the surgical suite, you get put under, you know, sedation, and then the surgeon will open a letter, like an envelope, and the envelope says either perform the surgery or don't. They perform the surgery, he sticks his guides in. This is you know, very basic kind of surgery where you cut out all the bad stuff that's going on that they find in the knee. So they are criteria, obviously, that identified arthritic changes, you know, that sort of thing. So he sticks his probes in, sticks in his little scissors, cuts out the bad stuff, sews you up, and sends you away. But if it says don't perform the surgery, then all he did was make the two incisions, stick the probes in, take them out, and cut and sew them up, meaning that he did the first step but didn't actually perform the surgery. Then he never sees that patient again. And the patient wakes up not knowing if they had the surgery or not, but they look down and they see two portals. They see two holes and they say, I guess I had the surgery because there it is. There's the cuts. And then the follow-up is done by someone who has never seen these people before, doesn't know what group anyone is in. So it's a so-called triple blind, because the person performing this, the research, is not actually performing the statistical analysis either. So what they found was, after 2 years, everyone was the same. People that got the bad stuff cut out felt great, and they performed, you know, walking activities and measures of their pain and function. But the people that didn't have the study, the surgery performed, felt the same way. They were also walking better, didn't have any problems, could do all their activities. In other words, it was as if everyone had the surgery. And the only thing that you conclude from that point is that that surgery has no greater effect than a placebo. That is amazing, right? That's an actual, that's a perfect example of removing all the bad stuff. Oh, you have knee pain, and here's evidence of arthritis, therefore it must be the arthritis. We'll cut that arthritis out, and lo and behold, they feel better. It's like an open and shut case, and it turns out it had nothing to do with any of the assumptions being made. And the reason why I bring this up is because the nocebo effect appears to be equally and oppositely powerful. So when we experience a nocebo effect, it has the potential to be just as strong as a placebo effect. And although this is a very elaborate kind of study, so there's a lot of placebo taking place, think about that for a second. We cured knee pain by letting someone think that they had a surgery. So what is someone doing when they're recommending that the activities and the behaviors, or the way that you walk, or the way that you move, or the way that you squat, is going to lead to the need for that type of surgery? what do you think might happen to the right individual in the wrong place? They may absolutely experience the pain that you've been warning them about by no other reason than the fact that you've been warning them about this pain. So exactly what you said, I think, is correct. If we see something wrong, fix it. Right? If we don't like the form, if we don't like the movement, fix it. But don't rely on the argument that by fixing it, you'll reduce their injury risk or potential. Because when we talk about injury, we're really describing pain. It doesn't matter if you have an injury that you never feel and it never affects you. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is pain, which is what changes and alters our movement and our behaviors. So if you can't predict with any type of reliability who might or might not experience pain and to what extent the damage may or may not be, don't rely on that as an explanation, because the only thing you've got to do is possibly make that individual worse. So talk about improvements in their form. Talk about improvements in the way that the exercise feels, or the amount of effort or power that they'll be able to produce when that form is better. Talk about the positives of moving well, not the potential negatives of somehow moving not well, which is ill-defined and not quite understood.
This is some super weird stuff. All right, you got my attention. You got my attention. Right. I'm interested now. If we wanted to, you know, probably going to start wrapping this up now, but for people out there who are, again, hearing about this stuff for the first time, what are just some take home points, some things to think about for to leave them with?
Okay. So I think the idea here is that pain is a part of normal human function, and it is a necessary part of normal human function. It's not something to be feared per se, but it's something that is important and defining in our lives. When we exercise, when we move, these are good things. These are things that nourish the brain. This is one of its primary objectives, is movement and coordination of movement. When we pathologize that movement or that position or that function, we create an environment that may actually lead to the idea that this movement or function is threatening. And threatening is a language of pain. It's what ultimately produces pain, the concept of threat. That concept can be a combination of any number of things. It can be physical stimulus. It can be societal stimulus and how a society deals and understands with injury and pain and dysfunction. It can also be something that occurs through a person's history, understanding, memories, emotions, stress. It is all-encompassing behavior. So just like you need a body to experience an injury, you also need a brain to experience that pain. But that doesn't mean that when we feel pain that it's somehow something made up. It's not made up. It's not imagined. It's a real experience of a person. But just like you can't tell someone, you know, the statement, "I love my wife," is something that you can neither prove nor disprove, right? "I feel pain" is the same type of statement. It's something that an individual experiences and an individual expresses for any number of reasons. So when you're working with other people or even with yourself, understanding what pain is doing, it's telling you that something is going wrong. It doesn't tell you what that something is. It doesn't tell you if that something is physical or if that something is the threat of something physical. You have to acknowledge it, understand it, not pay more attention than its value, than it's worth, but don't underestimate it either. You go, you seek help, and you seek alleviation of that pain. People that experience chronic pain, and we didn't talk too much about this, but there's a thread here. So an acute pain we think of as this immediate injury, and many times, and most of the time perhaps, that's probably the case. Look, if I bang my knee into a desk and I feel pain, it doesn't take a neuroscientist to tell you you're feeling pain because you banged your knee. But the actual experience of that pain is still based on all these other factors. When a person experiences chronic pain, the old explanation would be, well, this is tissue damage that keeps reoccurring. It keeps occurring in the same place. But only 2-3% of chronic pain conditions appear to have a physical cause. So what is more likely the case is that for whatever the reason, and there are multiple reasons that this can happen. You have an injury of some type, tissue damage of some type, or a threat of significance to tissue damage, and that threat basically stays on the mind. Now, it can change things in the nerve. It can change things in the sensory system itself. It can change the way that the brain perceives of the body. There are a lot of things that occur when we experience chronic pain, and there are many different forms of chronic pain. But understanding what that pain may be, and in the case of my wife, who has what's called a central sensitization, where it's not the physical body that's got a problem, but actually the nerves, the information center itself, the stuff that perceives. It's like a smoke detector that constantly goes off even when there's no fire, right? That's what she's experiencing. Then by understanding what pain is and looking at different ways, what's called a top-down approach versus bottom-up. Bottom-up meaning you have a boo-boo, I'll put a Band-Aid on it. Top-down means let's understand what that poo-boo is and why you feel it. These things can actually help an individual that is experiencing chronic pain. And the opposite sense, if you just talk about the physical means of injury, that can actually make someone worse. And ultimately, that's what I want my message to be, because everyone here has a role to play. When I, as a physical therapist, receive someone that is experiencing pain, especially chronic pain, a lot of the times I have to undo poor information that we know is no longer valid, but is still floating around in society and is actively floating. By undoing that and by educating them, I can help them in their journey and their experience of pain. But often it's the most difficult aspect, because you're fighting an entire society and an entire lifetime of understanding pain as of something that it's not. So all of us have a role to play, and I think personal trainers have a very special role to play here, because often you're that first line. You're the person that sees that patient over and over again. They come to you and you ask them their past medical history, and they say, I'm here to exercise because I have a bad back and I want to feel better. So you have a specific role in educating that client about what their pain is. It's a signal of threat. And by moving more, about enjoying the experience of movement, getting a little stronger, getting more confident, they're likely to help that pain experience. And not to fall back on the idea of you must have bad discs, you must have injuries, we have to be careful, we can't move a certain way, we can't do certain things. We don't want to scare people, we want to empower them. And through that empowerment, we can actually help them more so than we ever could before.
Super. All right, that's a good way to wrap it up.
There you go.
All right, so this is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to tell people out there. I want you to digest this. I want you to sit down. I want you to sleep on it. I want you to wake up and maybe listen to this one more time. And let's do a follow-up episode with John where you have, you know, some more specific questions about this stuff. And even, you know, potentially, do you think it would be good to if people gave specific examples of their pain history? Is that something that would be possible to discuss on like a podcast?
I don't want to get into like e-diagnosis. Right? Yeah, but we can, you know, there's so much to understand about this stuff and you know, questions arise all the time, you know, oh, so it's in my brain or it's in my head or, you know, somehow thinking it's all psychological or, you know, so, which it's not. Please, if you take anything away from this, it is not all in your head. So there are tons of questions that people tend to have for this type of information, because it seems counterintuitive until you stop and really consider the large pictures. But to our everyday experience, it seems counterintuitive, because like I said, you bang your elbow and you feel pain. Duh. Mm-hmm. What more? Why is it more complicated than that? So, but the value of that complication is extraordinary. So, you know, let people ask questions. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of them, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay, and yeah, let's do that, and we'll wrap it up by just saying, you know, thank you if you are a Patreon supporter of the FitCast. I really appreciate your support of making sure that this episode has been possible, and same thing for people out there that are making one-time donations through PayPal as well. Thank you so much. You guys are the best. And you can also check out the FitCast on iTunes. You can subscribe there and submit reviews if you enjoy the show. Also, you can follow myself on Twitter at Kevin Larrabee. You can find that on the show notes. And same thing with John. John is at John Fass?
Yeah, something like that.
And you are using Twitter a little bit more again, right?
Yeah. I'm trying.
It's what people use. People use it to communicate, and then you can also look for John on Facebook if you want to just check out some of the conversations and debates that are going on there. And I think that is about it. Like I said, again, can never say how much I appreciate everyone out there that does support the show. And if you haven't already, starting at just a dollar, you can do it. Just head to Patreon at PAT. This is one question I got. People not sure how to spell it. patreon.com/thefitcast. And starting at just a buck per episode, you can get the episodes 1 week early. Plus, I'm also putting up a bunch of bonus Fitcast Insider content that we did, I think including some stuff from John Fess from a while ago. So some good stuff on there, and I sound like I'm 14.
It'll probably like completely contradict everything that I said because I was all on the...
It's all good stuff. So again, thank you everyone out there. And John, it's great to talk to you. And if people want more of us, they can, you know, hang out after the music. We actually did an off topic like we did with Lee as well. So
we actually did.
Good to talk to everyone out there. Thanks for listening, and send in some more feedback, some questions for John, and we'll make sure we do a follow up. Thanks, John. All right, just like with Lee Peel a couple weeks ago now, I'm joined by someone that was on the podcast regularly to semi-regularly, Jonathan Fass, and we're going to talk about some stuff that's not fitness-related.
For like 5,000 episodes, I think, I was on. I lost count.
Yeah, there was a lot of them.
Yeah.
And then, then we had the whole thing that happened behind the scenes where,
right.
all that stuff went down, which, you know.
Right. And really, you know, as much as I appreciated you sending me dick pics, I really didn't know that that was appropriate. Yeah. I just want to say that that's water under the bridge, though. I don't mind. I know you were going through some things.
No, it was the constant barrage of studies and articles and. This person's wrong. This person's wrong.
Right. The fast book.
Yeah, I saw you even had your own. I'm staying with my buddy Rob, and he pointed out that you have like an alternate account on Facebook that someone made for you, too. So,
yes.
Guess you're doing the job.
Guess so.
So, while you're out in the desert, do you still get to check out any movies or watch any TV, or what have you been up to that isn't fitness related? Obviously, I don't know if I talked to you or you've been on the show since you got married, but you did that.
I did that. No, I think I was on the show once or twice.
I think Marianne came on after you got married, but you didn't.
Did she? That's possible. I don't remember. Did she?
I mean, she was on at some point. I just can't remember what it was.
Yeah, she was on. I thought it was before we got married, but I don't know. I feel like I was on once or twice, and I was yelling at you because you didn't even bring it up. And I was like, you son of a bitch, I got married. And then you're like,
yep, that's sound. Did you just record that? Did you just play back a recording?
That's probably what it was. So, yeah, no, we're hanging out. She's finally here with me. She's been since March. So,
Maybe you got married, but she wasn't there yet. Maybe
that's probably what it was. Yeah, there's a whole... I mean, you can't just visit Saudi Arabia. You need visas and all kinds of red tape stuff. So it actually takes quite a long time. So she was finally able to get over in March, somewhere like the middle of March, somewhere the Ides of March. So so she's been out ever since. Yeah, and we're just doing the Riyadh thing, which is basically staying in your compound and not going out.
It sounds like a blast.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not, you know, there's stuff to do. My hours kill a lot of that because I do work evenings. So
you're almost done though, right? What do you got, like a year left?
My contract's over in 6 months, so we'll just decide. Yeah, we'll just decide then, basically. Like, you know, we're kind of seeing, it's still 6 months to go, so we're not really making any, like, firm decisions. We'll just, you know, see how it goes and see what we decide to do and what opportunities are there and whatever, so.
And for the hardcore audience that are listening to this that stay for the off topic, this is like John and I literally, I don't think we've talked on in audio form in like 4 months, 5 months, 6 months.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So you're catching up with us as we catch up with us, which is fun. while you're in Saudi Arabia.
Meta,
yeah, I know. It's the same thing with Lee. Like I literally like started the Skype call with Lee and I'm like, all right, well I'm gonna start recording. So if we're gonna talk, we might as well share it with the 15,000 people that are gonna download. So you know, that is one of the staples that we had for like our super hardcore audience. Like that is something that they came to the show for, was to have us talk about stuff that was not related to and fitness, but also for some people, if we ever mentioned it on the main show, it was a negative review on iTunes. So
yeah, right.
That's why we tried to keep it.
We'd get these reviews and it'd be like your show sucks, but I love the off topic.
Yeah, or the vice versa. Like these guys vice don't versa, even get started for like the first 15 minutes. They just talk to each other. I'm like, well, you know, with that incarnation of the show, like that's what it was. It was just friends talking about, you know, fitness or whatever and taking questions and all that stuff. But, it's to kind of, the show is, it is like, what's the best way to put it? It's like the show gets relaunched every 2 or 3 years whenever I, you know, get the, you know, feeling to do something different, or scheduling is so hard to schedule between three people, with you being, you know, out in Saudi Arabia and Lee being Lee, where she's doing, like Lee was gone from the internet for a year. So it is, it's going to be good to catch up and to start recording some more stuff. And you've been doing some really cool stuff in terms of the research field. And I'm kind of bummed that you haven't started the podcast back up with,
I know.
With your stuff. So
yeah, it's there. I'm just
it's on the list.
Yeah, it's on the list of things to do. I've been actually pretty busy behind the scenes on a lot of stuff, but it is there, and I have no intention of letting it completely die. But it is.
Well, you've been writing at least. You've been contributing.
Yeah, I've been trying to been doing some actual like journal papers kind of stuff. I'm doing something with my colleague Israel Halperin right now, and just finished something else up with Justin Kampf that hopefully we submitted it for peer review, and hopefully it'll pass and get in publication. So yeah, some cool stuff like that. It's been fun.
Cool. And while you're out in Saudi Arabia, I'm in Japan right now. This is like the first episode I've actually recorded while in Japan, although we kind of faked it since I recorded a bunch ahead of time. But yeah, this is definitely a place that people should get out to. And I don't know, I might stay out here. So
sweet. Do you have to make a decision, or what are you going to do?
Well, I have 2 months to kind of feel it out. Okay. And I have the blessing from all the people that I need to, including work remotely and all that stuff. So, man, it's like, not to get too personal on the show, but it's stuff that John and I have talked about in the past when I go to him for advice about, you know, figuring out what that next step is in life and what's that thing that makes you feel a little bit less like a kid that's just got out of college and something more like an adult, or even if I want that. So, just figuring out maybe just go to Japan for a couple of years and have that experience. I mean, we're going to live to like 150, so we got some time.
Apparently.
That's what I think with all the stuff that we got going on. Either that, or we're just going to blow ourselves to hell. So, you know.
Either way, you got nothing to lose.
No. I mean, if we can go to, I'd either rather live to like 150, but if we're going to do that, it's going to be in a Judge Dredd, like Stallone Judge Dredd, not the good Dredd.
Right, clearly you'd want it to be the Stallone
Dredd. Yeah, well, I mean, no, that's the bad one. That's the one with like Taco Bell is like where you go to have fancy dinners and you use the three seashells to wipe your ass.
Well, right, but that's what I'm saying. Like the good one, the recent one, is like a hell to live in. But the bad one,
yeah, but it's a great movie. It's a kick-ass movie, man. Holy shit. Well, have you seen anything good lately? Have you been able to watch anything while you're out there?
I just finally saw X-Men First Class Part 2.
Oh, that's so, that's really good. Days of Future Past.
Yeah, it was really good, although in the continuity of the entire series, it makes no sense. But but as a standalone movie, it was excellent. But freaking as far nerd. As like, oh my God. Well, it's true, though. Why is Xavier alive? Why does he Wolverine suddenly have his claws again?
It's because Brett Ratner cannot make a good X-Men movie, so they decided to say X-Men 3 never happened.
No, but that's not... Oh, is that really what happened?
Well, basically, that's they're saying X-Men 3 never happened because Storm was around too.
Oh, that's
Storm right. died in X-Men 3.
She did, didn't she?
So they basically said, all right, we're going to pretend
did she
like...
Died in so-
yeah.
I don't remember.
I think so. Well, I don't know.
I know Xavier definitely, but I don't remember Storm dying.
Well, anyways,
well, whatever. But even then, Wolverine lost his claws, his adamantium in the last Wolverine. That was a decent movie. And then in the future, he's got his claws back.
In the Wolverine, he did not lose his. Adamantium.
Yeah, he lost the adamantium. He
oh, that's right.
Claws.
The robot thing yeah. sucks it out of him.
Yep.
Oh, whatever. Oh, wow. Yeah, that movie is... speaking of Tokyo and Japan, that movie is fantastic as well.
Yeah, it's not a bad movie.
A rated R Wolverine movie where he can chop dudes up and yeah. kill a lot of people.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. But it was like the continuity. They just didn't bother to explain any of it. So it's just like... okay. I mean, you can say, okay, maybe it was like alternate universe and whatever, which it kind of yeah. would be, but like it still didn't explain why Xavier was alive, except for the fact that at the end, then, you know, well, if you haven't seen the movie yet, whatever, but other people are alive. So you could say, okay, fine. So they changed the
timeline.
The timeline. But, and then it turns out that a major bad character in Wolverine might actually not have been that character or something. Like
yeah.
it just, yeah. So they were doing stuff where it's like, okay, that's awesome. Except wait, what? You know,
well, it's a fun movie. Just turn it off and go watch it because it's a blast and it's really, they really hit, you know, a home run with the humor and the action and stuff like
yeah.
that.
No,
so
no, no. As a standalone, it was a really good movie. And within the series, you're going, I just, what is going on?
And as a straight man, like I love looking at Hugh Jackman with his shirt off. Like I think that guy is a blast to look at.
He looked really good.
I have a lot of fun looking at him. He's jacked and he's ripped and he's like almost 50 now. So
seriously,
you can only squeeze a couple
really
more of these movies out of him. But
he looked really good. I was like, what the hell? I'm sitting there next to my wife watching it, being like, I'm so sorry for my... I just can't be that man.
It's like, I'm a professional, and I don't even... I know exactly what I would need to do to get there, but even I don't... Like, I'm sure I even know more than his celebrity trainer or whatever, but still, I couldn't get there. So, that's a good film. I actually watched Contact last night, hot joint from 1997, with Jodie Foster and Robert Zemeckis joint.
Classic.
Oh, it is. Man, that movie still holds up, and just like Jodie Foster is so friggin' sexy in that movie. Oh my God. She looks like I've never liked Jodie Foster in any movie ever, but I like her in that movie.
The movie was good. I don't
she wore some killer dresses and things like that. And I even have like, I distinctly remember like for Spanish class, like we used to get the Spanish HBO at my house. So, for Spanish class in high school, sometimes I'd convince my teacher, like as we got towards like Christmas or something like that, like, hey, let me, you know, record a movie in Spanish and bring it in and we'll watch, you know, a movie in Spanish. So I actually did it for that. And I also did it for Gone in 60 Seconds. So my class loved me because I was like the one kid that knew how to like record stuff off a TV with good quality. Nice. And I was able to convince the teacher to do that stuff. So,
Nerds shall inherit the earth.
What's that?
Nerds shall inherit the earth.
We'll see. Hope so. reading any good books? That's the last thing I want to ask you.
Yeah, wow.
What do you got?
Right now,
I'm
reading...
Not like science books, but like books.
Well, history book.
Yeah, yeah.
So debt the first 5,000 years.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Oh wow, what a it's one of those books that like
how like society like society has been built, so there's always like, you know, debt to be paid off. No, and stuff
well.
Like that.
Sort of. It's an economics book. It's economics history, which is one of my favorite topics in college.
Economics history, folks.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's fascinating because if you talk about economics, you're really talking about the psychology and it's social psychology. It's the means of production and the driving force of a society, and yet society drives that force. I mean, it's a fascinating topic. So when you look at economic history, you look at the development of societies, but from an economic standpoint. And what this book is arguing is that it's basically completely the opposite of what we've assumed as the kind of the creation myth of economics, as Adam Smith put it. So and to the point where economists know that and they disregard it anyway. They still tell these myths. So it's this amazing look at how society actually functions and why it functions and the creation of debt as a driver of market systems. And it's like, it's mind blowing. You just read this book and you're like, you got to stop every paragraph and just contemplate what you've been reading. I love books like that.
Yeah, that actually sounds kind of cool. I got a Kindle before going on my trip, and I've been doing a really good job of reading every night before bed. It's really, like, seriously, if you aren't doing this, like, it helps improve your sleep, and it's just so easy to do.
Yeah.
Stop turning on your cell phone or stop looking at your cell phone before going to bed. But I'm actually, man, I want to try to, I'm reading a book on nuclear disasters.
Huh.
And it's all about, oh, man, I don't have the the book in front of me right now, but anyways, it has to do with you know, the history of nuclear disasters and also like the discovery of, you know, things like I have it right here. Hold on. Atomic Accidents.
Accidents
is what it's called, and it's available on Kindle Unlimited, so you can actually get it for free if you're on the Kindle Unlimited subscriber. It's like the Netflix of books, and I really recommend checking it out just because it talks about, you know, crazy things like the environmental disasters just from dams failing, and the ecological
impact
and damages that it can have on that stuff is super interesting. Yeah. So if you want a book, and it is kind of sciencey, so it will kind of put you to sleep if you want that to happen. But I can usually get through like 5 or 6 pages a night, then I'm out. Which has been great to deal with jet lag.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, I was going to say also, I am actually listening to it. I have an Audible account, and it's like, if you do a lot of driving or even a decent amount, Audible is just an incredible, incredible thing. And Marianne and I listen to books too. So we'll like sit together, and instead of like watching TV or something, we're like, oh, you want to listen to that book? And we'll sit and we have books that we listen to together, and then we'll have books that we listen to apart. And you, like, if you have enough time, I mean, I probably go through a book a week just listening, and it's fantastic. It makes the drive good. It's awesome.
Yeah, sorry, I was muting myself for a second, but yeah, no, totally. But we should probably talk about that other stuff because I got to get to sleep at some point. I got a long hike in the morning. all right, so that is it. There's your taste of that stuff, and John's still alive, so that's great.
Yeah.
We'll go talk about some pain now.